did matter. Creating enough internal consistency to protect the idea of Star Wars, preventing the universe from ever having to reboot, was enough of a responsibility to humble even the most hardened first-generation Star Wars fan. The fan-edited online encyclopedia, Wookiepedia, didn't start up as a splinter group of Star Wars fans who'd been editing entries on Wikipedia proper until March 2005. Cheese Holocron would always have 3 years head start, though Wookiepedia would always be way more wordy. As Chee beavered away, the world was no less obsessed with codifying the language of Star Wars. On September 25, 2002, the terms Jedi, the Force, and Dark Side were officially entered into the Oxford English Dictionary. Meanwhile, in Texas, an energy brokering company called Enron was busy executing a secret plan to extort money from the state of California by artificially raising the cost of electricity. The plan was called Death Star. Enron helped set it up through subsidiaries called Jedi, Obi-Wan Holdings, Kenobi, and Chuco. Star Wars was a cultural institution now. Everyone, even the bad guys, loved the idea of it. Not even the worst Star Wars movie George Lucas could contrive to make would change that. The familiar cycle of the prequels was underway once more. Episode 3 had gone into pre-production shortly before Episode 2 arrived in theaters, at which point Lucas left for his now traditional family vacation. Returning in late August 2002, he once again had roughly 9 months to gestate the script before filming started. Once again, he would keep his design team updated on the locations he was planning to use, while keeping them in the dark about the script itself. It had worked once, as far as he was concerned, and it would work again. Before he wrote it, Lucas declared Episode 3 would be the most fun to do. Finally, we'd see the Clone Wars themselves. We'd see Anakin and Obi-Wan duel over volcanic lava, a scene Lucas had been ruminating on since 1977. And we'd see the final transformation of Skywalker into Vader. The new script should have come naturally. But for months, Lucas wrote nothing. "I've been thinking about it," he said in November. He still hadn't started by the first week in December 2002. "Take an aspirin," he suggested to a frustrated McCallum. "Aspirin?" the producer shot back. "I need to freebase." Lucas's problem, too many characters and concepts clamoring for his attention, more than the movie could possibly contain. Young Boba Fett's revenge on Obi-Wan for killing his father would be fascinating, but not essential. Ditto with seeing a 10-year-old Han Solo meeting Yoda on the Wookiee planet of Kashyyyk, a concept that made it as far as a design sketch and a single line of dialogue in the rough draft. Young Han to the Jedi Master, "I found part of a transmitter droid near the East Bay. I think it's still sending and receiving signals." Lucas was determined to shoehorn Peter Mayhew reprising his role as Chewbacca into the prequel trilogy, however, even if only for a few seconds. He wanted to show that Chewie had actually been a little short for a Wookiee all along. R2 and 3PO had to be in there too, simply because they needed to be in all 6 movies. To give Padme some purpose, he wanted to show her founding the Rebel Alliance. He needed to show the Jedi at war with clone troopers at their side and, initially, had the notion that we would see 7 battles simultaneously on 7 different planets. He felt he ought to kill off an important Jedi during the course of the movie, but pretty much every major character still alive at the end of Episode 2, Obi-Wan, Anakin, Yoda, survives into the classic trilogy in some form. He decided on Mace Windu. Samuel L. Jackson understood, but insisted on an important, grandiose death scene. The ending Lucas wrote for Episode 3 somehow didn't match up with the beginning of Episode 4, so he had to disassemble Episode 3 and rethink it. He would admit to author Marcus Hearn that he had painted myself into a corner with the script. His solution? Focus on Anakin's fall to the dark side at the expense of just about everything and everyone else. Boba Fett? Out. Padme founding the Alliance? Gone. 7 battles on 7 planets? Sayonara. Lucas was so boxed in by the needs of the plot that he couldn't even stay consistent to his own G-level canon. In Return of the Jedi, Princess Leia remembered her real mother, that is, Padme, being around. Kind, but sad, when Leia was a very small child. But Lucas felt it would make things that much more dramatic if Padme were to die while birthing her twins. The kind but sad interaction with Leia was reduced to a few seconds between heartbroken mother and child. By the end of January 2003, Lucas eked out a 55-page treatment for McCallum's Eyes Only. Its title, clearly mirroring and acquiring the abandoned word from the Return of the Jedi title, Revenge of the Sith. As with the rough drafts of Attack of the Clones, there was little here that would not make it into the final movie. Some differences. Anakin's vision of the future that drives him to the dark side involved Padme consumed by flames in the rough draft, rather than dying in childbirth as he foresees it in the final film. She eventually dies on the operating table, possibly by injuries inflicted by Anakin. In the script, Palpatine also makes clear to Anakin that he was able to manipulate his birth via the Force, causing the midichlorians to create him out of nothing. "You might say I'm your father," said Palpatine, in what was likely intended as an echo of Vader's most famous line in Empire. Anakin responded, just the way Luke did, "That's impossible." The rise to power of the Nixon-like overlord, the transition from Senator Palpatine in Episode 1 to Chancellor Palpatine in Episode 2 to Emperor Palpatine in Episode 3. This was a story Lucas had long been interested in telling in the prequels, and it would just about survive as a subplot. It was a pessimistic summary of his reading of history. "All democracies turn into dictatorships, but not by coup," he told Time before the launch of Episode 2. "The people give their democracy to a dictator, whether it's Julius Caesar or Napoleon or Adolf Hitler. Ultimately, the general population goes along with the idea." What kinds of things push people and institutions in this direction? That's the issue I've been exploring. How did the Republic turn into the Empire? How does a good person go bad, and how does a democracy become a dictatorship? That exploration would reach its end in Revenge of the Sith, peppered as it was with more political references than any other movie in the saga. Fans assumed that the dark overtones of Episode 2 were influenced by the political situation at the time. In 2002, it was hard to see a movie that featured a republic beset by terrorist bombings and war on distant planets, a republic sliding into dictatorship via the granting of emergency war powers, and not think you were watching a specific commentary on George W. Bush's administration post-9/11. But that wasn't Lucas's intent. When he'd finished his script of the movie in March 2000, Bush wasn't even president. Episode 3, however, was written around the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in March 2003. In the Bay Area, protests against the Iraq War and Bush were as hard to avoid as Vietnam and Nixon were during the writing of Star Wars, especially for a self-confessed news junkie like Lucas. Suddenly, after Anakin Skywalker is first dubbed Darth Vader and confronts Obi-Wan, we find him using this line, "If you're not with me, you're my enemy." Few adult listeners at the time would fail to pick up a reference to Bush's line in his speech to Congress on September 20, 2001. "Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists." Obi-Wan's response would have cheered the heart of every voter who felt some nuance was lost in Bush's black-and-white worldview. Only a Sith deals in absolutes. Promoting the film later, Lucas would declare his hostility to Bush for the first time, publicly comparing him to Nixon and Iraq to Vietnam. "I didn't think it would get this close," he told reporters at Cannes. The endless circle of politics, as Darth Vader might say, was now complete. As he wrestled with condensing all of this into a script, Lucas was riding his deadline like never before. By March 2003, he'd written half of a first draft. At a production meeting, he described the same mental block problems he'd had all those years ago. His enemies, he said, were inertia, procrastination. I sit there with that page in front of me. I can be chained to my desk and still not write it. He was forcing himself to finish 5 pages a day again. The script had come so easy in Attack of the Clones, when he had been jazz-riffing, loose and carefree. Now it was crunch time. His final Star Wars movie. The end of all loose ends. The arrival of Vader. And he might as well have been back in 1974. On April 10, 2003, with 12 weeks to go before shooting, Lucas finished a 111-page first draft in pencil. What had the creator decided this time? He had pulled back from Palpatine telling Anakin outright that he was his father, making Vader Luke's father, Leia his sister, and 3PO his sort of brother was fine, but apparently making the Emperor Luke's sort of grandfather was a familial step too far. Instead, Palpatine tells Anakin the story of another Sith Lord, Darth Plagueis, who was able to create life and end death, but was ultimately and ironically destroyed by his own apprentice, that is, Palpatine himself. He added Palpatine hinting that Obi-Wan was seeing a certain senator playing on Anakin's jealousy over Padme. When Anakin is revived in his Vader suit after his tragic duel with Obi-Wan, he asks Palpatine about Padme and is told she was killed by a Jedi. In the movie, this would become, "You killed her," filling Vader with self-loathing rather than rage against the Jedi Order. By early June, Lucas delivered a second draft of the script. In late June, 4 days before filming was to start in Australia, Lucas finished a quick third draft. Again, the shoot ended in September. This time, it was notable for having no location shots whatsoever. Everything was green screen. At the suggestion of Coppola and the urging of McCallum, Lucas hired an acting and dialogue coach, Chris Neal, who was, coincidentally, the son of Coppola's brother-in-law. Natalie Portman raved about Neal. Unfortunately, Portman was increasingly difficult to deal with on set. Some of the crew say she made several actresses playing her handmaidens, including Keira Knightley, age 12 in The Phantom Menace, cry in the previous prequels, allegedly for the crime of talking to her without permission. According to some Lucasfilm insiders, many of her lines were cut from Revenge of the Sith for that reason. She had little left to do but to be barefoot and pregnant with the Skywalker twins. Lucas had one more character to squeeze into the lineup after the movie was shot, though he would only appear on screen for seconds during the opera scene in which Palpatine tempts Anakin to the dark side, and he had never appeared in any of the other films to date. This character was key to the entire 6-movie arc. His name was Baron Papanoida, a blue-skinned playwright who, according to Wikipedia, built himself an entertainment empire on his home planet and liked to keep his past shrouded in mystery. The actor who played Papanoida was insistent that his daughter, Katie, be in the shot too. The actor's name? George Lucas. One final redrafting happened in post-production. Having assembled a rough cut of the film, many ILM staffers felt that Anakin didn't seem to have enough reason to turn to the dark side. Lucas screened the rough cut for Coppola and for Spielberg. Steven confirmed that most of everything was working, he said. But the more he edited, the more Lucas changed his mind. He added another vision of Padme dying in childbirth, making absolutely certain the audience would understand that this was the reason Anakin turned to the dark side. Originally, the reason Anakin saved Palpatine from Mace Windu's lightsaber and killed Windu himself was because Skywalker believed there was a Jedi conspiracy against Palpatine. Christensen and McDermott were called in one last time to re-loop their dialogue. Now, Anakin killed Windu because Palpatine insisted he knew how to save Padme. This, then, became Episode 3's shock reveal, the equivalent of the Clone Wars fake-out. Anakin became Darth Vader out of a selfish kind of love. He wanted to hold on to his wife at all costs. Lucas compared the result to Faust. But the plot was so disrupted by this decision that Lucas had left what he called a couple of sharp right turns on the road to the Faustian bargain. Case in point, Anakin tells Windu that Palpatine is a Sith who should be arrested, moments before he decides to kill Windu. Another few minutes go by, and Anakin is knighted as Darth Vader and declares he will kill all the Jedi. A few minutes more, and he's slaughtering children off-screen at the Jedi Temple. This, in the end, is perhaps the most mystifying decision in the entire prequel trilogy. Vader's long conversion to the dark side was the story Lucas supposedly wanted to tell. Fans once assumed this fall would be spread over 3 movies. In the end, the fall took place in fewer than 10 confusing minutes. Everywhere at ILM, it seemed, all of Star Wars was being fixed up and given a new coat of paint. Not just Episode 3, but the now complete sextet. Lucas was preparing to release the original trilogy on DVD, the special edition version, of course, though it would lose that nomenclature. It would simply become Star Wars Episodes 4, 5, and 6, with hundreds more scenes tweaked or tinkered with. It became clear that Star Wars, to Lucas, was no historical document. It was a race car to be constantly tuned up and decked out. The same was true of THX 1138. Lucas released a special edition of his first movie in 2004, a week before the Star Wars box sets. It featured all new digital additions, such as a machine that helps THX masturbate in front of the holograms, and mutant monkeys attacking the protagonist just before his final escape. By now, Lucas had at his command an unprecedented bevy of digital artists, adept enough to do anything he wanted, including the difficult task of grafting actors' lip movements from one take onto another. He could move actors from one side of a set to the other after the fact. The Star Wars universe, the part that appeared on screen at least, was his to manipulate. He would probably never have this chance again, with this many artists and this many actors under contract for pickup scenes. He replaced actor Sebastian Shaw as Anakin Skywalker's Force Ghost at the end of Return of the Jedi, with one played by Hayden Christensen. Sound designer Matthew Wood added his Jar Jar Binks-like Gungan voice to the end of Jedi, the last audible dialogue of the entire series, over a new scene of celebration on Naboo. Wisa free! It might as well have been the creator saying it. The saga was finally over. He had triumphed over fan angst. He had pivoted from a millionaire into a billionaire. He had broken records, reached milestones, proved everything he had set out to prove with digital cinema. Hampered by an inability to write dialogue, he had decided not to sweat it, and in the process, he took Star Wars back to its schlock-filled Flash Gordon roots. He'd completed and polished a 12-hour saga as he saw fit, and dropped in educational lessons about the fragility of democracy and the suffering that comes from attachment. Now it was time for the creator to tell the diehard fans what some of them might have expected and some were shocked by. There were to be no more movies. Lucas dropped this news while attending the triennial Star Wars Celebration Convention for the first time at Celebration 3, held in Indianapolis in April 2005, just prior to the release of Revenge of the Sith. During a Q&A session, Lucas was asked about whether there would one day be an Episode 7, following on from Return of the Jedi this time. After all, Dale Pollack had written that he had seen treatments for Episodes 7 through 9, but was sworn to secrecy about their contents. Pollack remains quiet on this matter even now, except to say that he remembers being excited about them and thinking them the best possible movies. But for all we know, each treatment was no more than a few sentences long. Indeed, Lucas's answer seems to suggest that's an overestimate. To be very honest with you, I never ever thought of anything that happened beyond Episode 6, Lucas said. It's the Darth Vader story. It starts with him being a young boy, and it ends with him dying. The other books and everything kind of go off on their path, but I never really considered ever taking that particular story further. Another answer he gave at the same session seemed to almost beg the fans not to demand more of him. Star Wars is something to enjoy, and take away what you can from it that maybe helps you in your lives, he said. But don't let it take over your lives. You know, that's what they say about Trekkies. Star Wars fans don't do that. The point of the movies is to get on with your lives. Take that challenge. Leave your uncle's moisture farm. Go out into the world and save the universe. But as it soon turned out, neither Lucas nor the fans were done with Star Wars yet. 24. Building character. As far as the hardest of the hardcore fans are concerned, the old Kenner slogan, "Star Wars is forever," is an article of faith. You'll hear them say it almost as often as the slightly more syrupy motto, "Star Wars brings people together." All that energy fans bring to the franchise, they don't necessarily use it to get off their metaphorical Tatooine moisture farms the way Lucas wanted. If that's the metaphor you're looking for, then let's say they form a kind of moisture farm collective, move into the hover car storage area of their homesteads, and start tinkering on these garage projects. They cluster on the internet according to the nature of these projects. Do they save the universe this way? Not in the strictest definition, but they certainly build community. We've already seen how Albin Johnson and the 501st Legion made a community of space soldiers appear from nothing. At the fringes of the organization, the 501st bleeds into a couple of communities devoted to the only two characters who appeared in all six movies, R2-D2 and C-3PO. No prizes for guessing which one is more popular, but both droidly communities have managed to achieve a strange kind of symbiosis with Lucasfilm. Take the story of Chris Bartlett, a stormtrooper with the 501st, who decided in 2001 he wanted to build a screen-realistic 3PO costume. This was an order of magnitude more difficult than a realistic Vader or Boba Fett or stormtrooper. No one outside the walls of Lucasfilm had really managed it at that point. Bartlett, however, was determined. He was thin enough, he was bumbling enough, and damn it, he could be 3PO. He had acquired an old Disneyland 3PO costume from 1997, but the suit was too big, its head especially. It just didn't look like everyone's favorite protocol droid. Bartlett worked with collectors who had life-size 3PO statues and a friend in a fiberglass shop. Over the years, they put together a kind of Frankenstein 3PO that eventually came to resemble the real thing. Bartlett, a very slender man, was just the right shape to make it work. He had a microphone and amp installed in the suit, and played the classic trilogy on DVDs in his car on his commute, trying to get 3PO's voice just right. I always thought, wouldn't it be neat if someone at Lucasfilm saw the costume and wanted to use it for something, Bartlett said. He never imagined it would happen until he sent a picture of the outfit, just gold spray painted, not yet chromed, to a friend in Lucasfilm licensing. 3 months later, Bartlett sent the suit off to a shop in Southern California that could do the chrome plating, and got a call from the video games division, LucasArts, that same day, asking to borrow the costume. "Don't you have like 15 of these?" he asked, incredulous. "We have 4," came the reply, "and they're all in museums." A call was made to the chrome shop to speed up the process from 5 weeks to 1, such is the power of the Lucasfilm name. A week later, Bartlett found himself flown out to San Francisco, where he assembled the suit in a conference room at Lucasfilm's headquarters. 3 hours later, unexpectedly, he found himself on a plane to Sydney, where he delivered a rather dry and technical speech about the video game Star Wars Galaxies in full 3PO regalia. He got a paycheck and a plane ticket to Australia. Lucas got its marketing messaging delivered by the best kind of fan express. If a person was giving the speech, you'd lose half the audience, Bartlett says. But if you see 3PO giving it, you pay attention. Bartlett has been Lucasfilm's official event 3PO ever since. Now a member of the Screen Actors Guild, he has even received training from Anthony Daniels himself. Bartlett has appeared in Disney Channel shows and Toyota and McDonald's commercials, presented Samuel L. Jackson with an award on the cable channel AMC, and most memorably, was dispatched at the last minute to the White House in October 2009 to take part in a Halloween trick-or-treat event. After assembling his costume in the basement of the West Wing, Bartlett and Lucasfilm's official Chewbacca took the closet-sized elevator to the second floor. It stopped at the first, at which point the doors opened and the President of the United States appeared. "Can I get on with you guys?" he asked. "Hello," said Bartlett in pitch-perfect voice via his amp. "I am C-3PO, Human-Cyborg Relations."
"Wow, you guys look awesome," grinned Obama.
"Well," Bartlett remarked to Chewbacca, echoing 3PO's line on first meeting Lando, "he seems very friendly." Obama proceeded to introduce 3PO to Michelle and the kids. Michelle, it turned out, had specifically asked for the droid. Bartlett looked around and noted that Obama's press secretary, Robert Gibbs, was dressed as Darth Vader. His son was Boba Fett. Once again, proof that an obsession with Star Wars had found its way to the most powerful office in the world. Bartlett can barely wear the costume for longer than an hour. Moving across a room without overheating is a challenge, as is the supermodel diet he needs to fit into the suit. "It's the character you have to stay the most in shape for," he says. "I had to lose 10 pounds between Christmas and my next Lucasfilm event. You can't have a paunch at all, because that's where it shows, in the middle. The wires start bulging. But it's worth it," he says, "for that momentary magical interaction." The other group of droid enthusiasts is even more self-effacing and tenacious than Bartlett and his fellow masked character makers in the 501st. Like Lucas, they prefer life behind the scenes. For this reason, as well as for their choice of character, and the fact that they're never done tinkering, they would seem to be the branch of fandom closest to George Lucas's heart, which might help to explain why they were the first Star Wars fans to actually work behind the scenes on one of the movies. I speak, of course, of the R2 Builders Club. In a garage in American Canyon, California, Chris James is showing me a screen-perfect R2-D2 replica. It took him a decade to build. "He's mostly aluminum," says James, and the droid bleeps randomly. "Yes, R2," he says, absent-mindedly, as if to a pet. James is a 5'3" Welshman with gleaming, bespectacled eyes, a cheery smile, and a long, scraggly beard that blends into his torso. If R2 were to take human form, he might look something like James. James's creation is detailed as exactly and exactingly as any official Lucasfilm version. The difference is that James and his fellow builders have gone so far as to name every nook and cranny. "We call these things coin slots," James says, pointing to the slim holes down the droid's side. A larger indent at the bottom of the base unit is the coin return. The tapering part at the bottom is the skirt and the booster cover. The legs run on wheelchair motors connected to 12-volt batteries. "Most droids are 12-volt, like a car," James says. With this much power flowing through them, droids like James's R2 have incredible stamina. He can run up to 10 hours, depending on how much he's driving around. The car metaphor is especially appropriate, given the builder's reputation on planet Star Wars. Bonnie Burton, former Lucasfilm social media manager, calls the R2s the muscle cars of Star Wars fandom. "They break down all the time like muscle cars," she says. Burton should know. A huge R2 fan, she staged a wedding between herself and the diminutive droid at Celebration 5 in 2010. Darth Vader was the best man. Darth Maul the officiant. Maul asked Burton if she vowed to take unnatural pride in your relationship in times of full battery charges, as well as times of loose wires and astromech malfunctions. Like the R2 builders, she said, "I do." Lucas's only stipulation in allowing the wedding to go ahead, she knows it's not real, right? Fan-built R2s have long been more realistic than the Lucasfilm versions. James's R2 can spin its head all the way around, which is something the movie R2 could never manage. James takes the dome off to show me the Lazy Susan inside, mounted on ball bearings, and the slip ring that prevents the fiber optics in R2's head from getting tangled up. Decapitated, R2 bleeps sadly. The dome is replaced, and we continue the lesson in droid anatomy. This R2 used to have a periscope that came out of the top of his dome until a kid broke it off at a maker fair. Goes with the territory, James shrugged. He repaired it some months after our meeting. The droid's main eye is simply the radar eye, while the one that glows red-blue underneath it is the process state indicator. The blinking colored lights are the logics. The three nozzles on the top, which on the 1976 R2 model were Bakelite reading lights from old airplanes, are the unit's holoprojectors, or HPs. The R2 builders came up with many names, which have since been incorporated into official Lucasfilm literature. "Would you like to see his hologram?" James asks. I nod. "Of course." James flips a switch on a tiny remote. A high-tech custom-built RC device that James 3D printed, hidden in his pocket. R2's side opens, and out comes a car radio antenna with a rare see-through Princess Leia action figure dangling off the end. R2 plays her message. "Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope." The hologram gag came from James's wife, Tammy, and was an idea he initially dismissed. "Now I get more bang for the buck on that thing than anything else in it," he says. The R2 Builders Club was founded in 1999, around the time Episode 1 came out, by an Australian named Dave Everett. It grew out of a small group of builders on a popular website called the Replica Prop Forum. Other than a hacker space Everett runs in Sydney, there is no physical clubhouse. This is basically an internet club for introverts. The R2 builders now claim more than 13,000 members around the world, far more than the 501st. But the vast majority have not yet completed an astromech, as R2's breed of droid is known. Only 1,200 members are actively posting. That's because building R2 is like summiting the Everest of Star Wars fandom. It requires tremendous commitment and years of practice, but like Everest, increasingly, it is within reach. James has devoted 10 years to his astromech so far, which is not unusual, nor is the $10,000 he estimates he has sunk into it. It helps that James is a former Silicon Valley software engineer who retired from his job at Hewlett-Packard in 2012 at age 42. The most challenging aspect of building an astromech is that it is true DIY. Even within the Builders Club, there is no factory churning out astromech parts. "That's the bit people really don't understand," says Gerard Fajardo, a technician for General Motors who joined the Builders Club 12 years ago and took that long just to make all the parts for his R2. "If you're buying parts from other builders and you try to put them together, they won't work. Next thing you know, you're out buying a grinder to try to get the screw holes to fit where they're supposed to." Club members may band together in a metal shop to build the dome, say, the most difficult part to construct and the part most likely to roll off your workbench and get a dent. Luckily, dents and scratches help make a true Star Wars-like astromech. The used universe strikes again. Some of these R2 builders had been working haphazardly on their hobby even before the Builders Club was founded in 99. James built his first R2 unit out of wood, cardboard, and plastic around 1997. Others built astromechs out of plastic or resin parts. Everett has posted free plans that let you build a whole droid minus the dome out of a few sheets of styrene. Cost? $500. Paint it, and it'll look pretty realistic. But once you've come that far, why not go the whole R2? For years, the droid builders struggled to make their astromechs accurate. Lucasfilm wasn't shutting them down, but it didn't supply so much as a single measurement for them to use as a reference. Builders had to guess R2's dimensions based on production stills and screen images. One club member went to the Magic of Myth exhibit, a collaboration between Lucasfilm and the Smithsonian that toured the world from 1997 to 2003. Enjoying a camera with laser pointers strapped to both sides in a bid to accurately assess the size of an R2 behind glass. Greater love hath no dork for his droid. Everything changed in 2002, at the second Star Wars celebration, the same one at which the 501st was providing security and winning over Lucasfilm. Don Bees, an ILM model maker who was in charge of the company's archive, brought one of its dozens of R2s to the convention. Accidentally, on purpose, Bees left the droid in the Builders Club room overnight. Members rushed in with tape measures. "This was the first time we got to touch an official R2 unit," James says. The club still calls it the Uber Droid. There remained the mystery of what color blue R2 had been painted. That sounds like it would be easy to ascertain, but it is maddening. On screen, R2 seems a slightly different shade of blue depending on what scene you watch. The paint has an odd translucent quality. In some set photographs, R2 looks almost purple. It turns out that the builders of the original R2s had used a protective blue dye that is commonly applied to aluminum before cutting the parts out of a sheet. The dye is supposed to be temporary and gets darker the longer it stays on, hence the confusing color changes. For episode 2, Bees had helped ILM come up with a new permanent R2 color. Again, he couldn't officially leak it to the R2 builders, but hypothetically, Bees wrote on the Astromech message boards, "If I was going to paint one, here's what I'd order from House of Color." He then gave a very specific mix of paint colors. The builders started calling the suggested mixture hypothetical blue. What kind of person devotes a decade of hobby time to building a droid? In the Bay Area alone, James says, the club boasts an opera singer, a dentist, and a philosopher. None of these people had any mechanical or electrical background, he says. They all have a love of building R2. The vast majority are men, unsurprisingly, in their 30s and 40s, just old enough to have seen the original movie when it came out, and now old enough to have a house, usually a garage. One builder put his R2 together on the dining room table for 6 months, to his wife's chagrin, and disposable income. The goal is not necessarily to complete one. When I asked club member Grant McKinney when he was going to finish his droid, the answer was, hopefully never. There's always a new challenge, a new way to deck out your astromech. Right now, the holy grail of the Builders Club is something they call 3-2-3, the ability for a droid to go from 3 legs to 2 and then to 3 again, at the same speed as R2 is seen to do in the movies. Without his 3rd leg, as the crew of Star Wars found out to its chagrin, R2 has a tendency to topple over. There are other kinds of astromech droid. You may recall R5-D4, the red droid that Luke and Uncle Owen were going to buy from the Jawas until it blew its motivator. The builders have significantly expanded this repertoire. One 501st member who dresses as Darth Vader built an all-black dark side droid. When 501st founder Alban Johnson revealed that his daughter Katie had brain cancer and she had asked for an astromech to watch over her, it was the R2 Builders Club that banded together to create one. Thus was born R2KT, an all-pink droid. Katie got to see and embrace it in July 2010. She passed away the following month. R2KT lived on, enshrined in the franchise in an episode of the Star Wars TV show, The Clone Wars. But it is R2, the original astromech, who commands most of the club's time and attention. When builders take their R2 units out in public, it's not hard to see why. "He's a celebrity wherever you go," says James of his droid. "You could have the best Vader or Fett or even a Wookiee, but when R2 rolls in, everyone just flocks to him." Why is that? Why on earth would a monocular trash can hold our interest and gain our sympathy? Ask any R2 builder, and they'll give you the same answer. It's the voice. Those expressive bleeps that Ben Burtt created out of his own synthesized baby talk have been transferred to MP3 files and stuck inside hundreds of astromechs. The sad chirp, the excited noise, the petulant whine, the high-pitched squeal. When timed exactly to his curious head movements, the way Lucas and Burtt made sure they were in the movies, the sounds give us the sense of a lovable animal, one that appears to appeal especially to women. Not for nothing was R2 portrayed in a Lucasfilm mockumentary written by Bees called Under the Dome as a rock star with a drinking problem and multiple girlfriends. I watched R2 work the crowd at Barbot, a San Francisco event at which inventors compete to mix cocktails by machine. R2 attracted more admirers than any robot bartender. James stood off to the side, remotely controlling the droid so it appeared to be interacting with the most curious members of the crowd, again, usually women. James's wife need not be concerned, however. To have his creation be the center of attention is the whole point. He's proud of how easily his prototype remote can go undetected, and happiest when someone is frantically looking around, trying to figure out who's controlling the droid. With R2, you can play up and do cheeky things you'd never do for real, James says. He's an extension of you. You do have this invisible connection. The R2 builders got the ultimate accolade at Celebration 3, three short years after they first got their hands on the Uber droid. Lucas and Rick McCallum came to visit the droid room at the convention. Making conversation, they asked the builders how much each droid had cost them. Around $8,000 to $10,000, came the reply. The droid builders report that the creator and his producer were a little surprised by that number. Jaws hit the floor. ILM and its subcontractors had been charging Lucasfilm $80,000 per droid. If we ever make another Star Wars movie, McCallum said, you guys are hired. Lucas has let it be known that R2 is his favorite character. He's the one Lucas liked to imitate on set. One happy story from the desert shoot of Return of the Jedi was that Lucas pranked Anthony Daniels by standing in as R2, crawling alongside him on all fours and bleeping. R2 is prominent in every movie. Unlike 3PO, he arrives in Episode 1 fully formed. Also unlike 3PO, he doesn't get his mind wiped at the end of Episode 3, which might explain why he's so willful on Tatooine in Episode 4 about connecting with Obi-Wan and ensuring that his former master's son rescues his former master's daughter. R2 saves the lives of every main character in both trilogies. Plot-wise, he never puts a tripod foot wrong, unlike Yoda or Obi-Wan or the entire Jedi Order. When the droid showed up for his first day on the set of Revenge of the Sith, Lucas told animation director Rob Coleman his ultimate framing device, that the entire story of Star Wars is actually being recounted to the keeper of the Journal of the Wills. Remember that? 100 years after the events of Return of the Jedi by none other than R2-D2. So if there is one eternal truth to every Star Wars movie, it isn't that the Force will be with you, since the Force appears as likely as not to lead you down the dark path. It's that R2-D2 is the man, and evidently, he has the potential to absorb more of your life than all the other characters put together. The happy postscript to this chapter came while I was finishing this book. Lucasfilm announced that two British members of the R2 Builders Club, Lee Towersey and Oliver Steeples, would be elevated to the pantheon of Star Wars creators. Kathleen Kennedy, following in Lucas and McCallum's footsteps, got a tour of the R2 Builders area at Celebration Europe 2013. Said Steeples to Kennedy, half-joking, "If you need us for Episode 7, we're ready." Kathleen took him at his word. It made perfect financial sense and formed part of Lucasfilm's strategy of outreach to the hardcore fans. And so it came to pass that Kennedy allowed herself to be photographed and tweeted next to an R2, J.J. Abrams, Towersey, and Steeples. A week later came the first confirmation of a character appearing in Episode 7. It was R2. Towersey and Steeples would put their own version of the Uber droid, painted hypothetical blue, front and center in the saga. 25. How I Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love the Prequels. As much as activities like droid building and costume making brought Star Wars fans together in the 2000s, arguments over the quality of the prequel trilogy tore them apart. No one doubted that episodes 1 through 3 were a giant experimental leap forward for digital filmmaking, or that they left a large imprint on our culture. Even the term prequel itself was not in common currency until 1999. But nor did anyone doubt that the movies left a bad taste in millions of moviegoers' mouths.
Over the decades since their release, the prequels have inspired a level of enmity that doesn't seem to be going away.
Because as much as Lucasfilm would like to believe the divide is a generational conflict, the truth of the matter is much more murky. If you could pinpoint the moment this divide began, it would have to be May 19, 1999, shortly after midnight at screenings across America. Specifically, the second the crawl said, "Turmoil has engulfed the Galactic Republic," before the dull reason for that turmoil, taxation of trade routes, crossed the screen. It was, as we know from the Idle Hands story, a beautiful, shining moment of fan unity. There's a reason why director Kyle Newman's 2007 movie Fanboys, which deals with a group of Star Wars nerds trying to steal an early print of Phantom Menace from Skywalker Ranch in order to screen it for a dying friend, ends at this moment. Our heroes, who still haven't seen Episode 1, sitting in the theater on May 19 as the lights go down. One asks another, "What if it sucks?" Fade to black. Newman is actually pro-prequel, but he wanted fanboys to recall the positivity and goodwill of that now fabled era between the special editions and the prequels. "People were getting back into it," he says of the Star Wars franchise. "There was an energy. It was bringing people back together." After that, there's no denying something changed. Fandom divided. Sure, there had been debates over the special editions. Some fans weren't all that keen on Return of the Jedi. But the crisis that was about to descend on Star Wars fandom would make heated arguments over Ewoks look like a minor disagreement over the finer points of lightsaber coloring. It wasn't just that some fans loved the prequels while others loathed them. There were those whose affections shifted one way or another, slowly, over months or years, and there were those who were able to convince themselves of the movie's worth over time. Newman says that a sequel to Fanboys, if he were to film such a thing, would open after Attack of the Clones and mirror this splintering of Star Wars fandom. One of his characters, Hutch, would be angry about everything in the movie. Another, Windows, would be the rationalizer, explaining away every questionable plot choice. The third lead, Eric, would play the arbitrator, which is where I sit in the debate, mildly disappointed but curious about whether the rationalizers can make me believe again. The Hutches of the Star Wars fan world, by their nature, tend to have the loudest voices. You can see their reaction to the prequels by watching Simon Pegg, the British actor later to play Scotty in J.J. Abrams' Star Trek, in Pegg's 1999-2001 UK sitcom, Spaced. In imitation of the scene at the end of Return of the Jedi in which Luke Skywalker burns Vader's corpse on a funeral pyre, Pegg's character burns his Star Wars collection in his backyard after seeing Phantom Menace. It was played as comedy, but Pegg, a lifelong passionate fan, had a similar reaction to the prequels in 2010. He called Phantom Menace a boring, turquoise, confused mess of pretentious masquerading as children's entertainment. Pegg also says Lucas offered him this advice at the London premiere of Episode 3. "Don't suddenly find yourself making the same film you made 30 years ago." In Spaced, Pegg wasn't really acting when he is seen yelling at a child in his comic book store who asks for a Jar Jar Binks doll. "You weren't there at the beginning! You don't know how good it was, how important! This is it for you! This jumped-up fireworks display of a toy advert!" Ah, yes. The kids. Newman's three characters are useful avatars for the different factions of adult Star Wars fandom, but children who love the prequels are an equally numerous and constantly refreshed group worth considering. Lucas is keenly aware of this fourth faction. The creator has in fact simplistically suggested that the only divide in his fandom is along the lines of age. "We know we had a real honest-to-God generation gap with Star Wars," George Lucas said at Celebration 5 in 2010 in an interview on stage with Jon Stewart. "Everybody over 40 loves episodes 4, 5, and 6, and hates 1, 2, and 3. Kids under 30 all love 1, 2, and 3 and hate 4, 5, and 6. This caused a commotion in the audience, such that Lucas was nearly shouted down. "If you're 10 years old," he shouted back, "stand up and fight for your rights." But the demographics of Star Wars fandom were never as cut and dry as Lucas suggested. I know a 10-year-old who hates Phantom Menace, but thinks Return of the Jedi and Revenge of the Sith are the greatest movies ever. Kids are like that, as Lucas surely knows, unpredictable and picky. They like or dislike movies in the rather more innocent way that Lucas once spoke of, the way you enjoy a sunset, and they tend to change their opinions dramatically as they get older. "It was a magnificent spectacle as a child," says Liz Lee, star of the MTV high school mockumentary My Life as Liz. "That's when CGI was still exciting." Lee was 8 years old at the time Phantom Menace came out. Now she's 21. She's still enough of a Star Wars fan to get a tattoo representing the Mandalorians, the warrior race who wear the armor of Boba and Jango Fett. "The older I get," she says, "the more I appreciate the original trilogy, and the more I start to resent the prequels. It's not like I'm angry about it, but my adult self isn't as into them." Regardless of age, everyone's reaction to the movies is slightly different. Many fans love one of the prequels and hate two, or love two and hate one, as did Newman, who found nothing at all to like in Attack of the Clones. Perhaps you've wondered, as I have, what to do with your uneasiness about the prequels. Perhaps you too have wondered if it is simply impossible to enjoy any new Star Wars movie if you're over 20 or 30 or 40. We won't really know until Episode 7 repeats the experiment on a planetary scale. In the meantime, a bit of amateur therapy can help to ease the pain, and it begins with working through the 5 stages of Star Wars prequel grief. The first stage of grief, of course, is denial. You can take the movies you don't like and simply declare they don't exist. Remember Chris Junta, the guy who got engaged right before the midnight screening of The Phantom Menace with a little help from Rick McCallum? Fast forward 15 years. Junta is back in Maryland, in a house outfitted with a resin-cast bar that looks exactly like Han Solo frozen in carbonite, a screening room-quality home theater system, and an absolutely firm policy. No prequels. Ever. "None of my 3 kids have seen the prequels or the special editions," he says. "I have the 1996 Laserdisc of the original trilogy, and that's all they've ever seen." The girls understand that there is other Star Wars, and that Daddy gets mad when it's brought up. My son is 7. He's got friends at school who watch the Clone Wars cartoons. He says, "Dad, there are other Star Wars movies." I say, "No, they're not real Star Wars movies." A less extreme version of the denial response is represented by something called machete order. Colorado programmer Rod Hilton came up with this on his blog Absolutely No Machete Juggling in November 2011, hence the name. To Hilton's surprise, machete order became an internet phenomenon and was widely discussed online throughout 2012. Machete order was Hilton's response to the problem of what order to watch the saga in. After all, watching them in numerical order spoils the biggest surprise of the series, Episode 5's I Am Your Father, because a new viewer would learn Luke's parentage in Episode 3. But watch the classic trilogy before the prequel trilogy, and you're confronted with the elderly Emperor before the young Palpatine, so his character arc is spoiled too. Not to mention Hayden Christensen's Force ghost at the end of the post-2004 version of Return of the Jedi. Who the heck, you might wonder, is that guy? Machete Order compromises by presenting the saga this way. Episodes 4, 5, 2, 3, and finally 6. This essentially makes the prequels an extended flashback after the parental relocation. The question of whether Vader is telling the truth, and if so, how it happened, adds new tension to Episodes 2 and 3. The identity of the Emperor is preserved. Episode 1 is omitted altogether, and its loss is not felt because every character established in it is either killed or removed before it ends, says Hilton, or established better in a later episode. Search your feelings. You know it to be true. Those who've tried Star Wars marathons the Hilton way report a welcome ominous feeling creeping in during the two remaining prequels, with the Machete Order, raved the website Den of Geek. The control of the Emperor over the universe feels absolute and tyrannical. His knowledge of the dark side of the Force is insurmountable. The end of the Emperor is the greatest day for the universe in 30 years. It gives justification to the scale of the celebrations that follow. Would George Lucas object to Machete Order? In one sense, yes. He stands by Episode 1. But the creator certainly knows the power of reordering movies in the saga, because that's what he was intending to do all along with the prequels, to change your perspective on the classic trilogy. Part of the fun for me was completely flipping upside down the dramatic track of the original movies, Lucas said. If you watch it the way it was released, you get one kind of movie. If you watch 1 through 6, you get a completely different movie. It's extremely modern, almost interactive movie making. You take blocks and move them around, and you come out with different emotional states. Star Wars fans embraced the interactive possibilities of the series as far back as 2000, when an LA-based film editor called Mike J. Nichols put together a poorly trimmed-down version of Episode 1, called The Phantom Edit. It was 20 minutes shorter than the original. In Nichols's version, scenes flashed by at speeds that might give even Land of Zoom super editor Lucas whiplash, if he ever watched it. Lucasfilm has stated the creator has no interest in seeing any kind of bastardized version of his work. Much of Jar Jar's dialogue was removed, making the Gungan more of a Buster Keaton-style silent comedian. Ditto with Jake Lloyd's dialogue as 9-year-old Anakin. The edit was distributed anonymously online. It was burned onto DVDs and passed around by hand. Lucasfilm stepped in when it heard that bootleggers, and some video stores, were starting to sell copies of the DVD, which crossed the line from enthusiastic fan edit to copyright violation. We realized that these were fans having some fun with Star Wars, which we've never had a problem with, Lucasfilm spokeswoman Jean Cole said in June 2001. But over the last 10 days, this thing has grown and taken on a life of its own, as things sometimes do when associated with Star Wars. 2 weeks later, Nichols apologized and said that his well-intentioned editing demonstration had escalated out of my control. Lucasfilm confirmed to me that Lucas has no interest in watching the Phantom edit. The commercial bootlegging would fade away with increased bandwidth speeds and the rise of file-sharing sites. If you could download a high-definition version of something like the Phantom edit for free, why would you pay a guy on the street for an inferior DVD copy? Indeed, Nichols was only the first in a long line of re-editors. These days, you can find hundreds of versions of each Star Wars movie, the original included, fixing dialogue and removing all sorts of perceived errors. One of the most intriguing and impossible to find was an edit of all three prequels into a single 85-minute film by the TV actor and film nerd Topher Grace. Grace only screened it as a one-time thing, according to Newman, one of the few who got to see it. Fan edits are a prime example of read-write culture as opposed to read-only culture, according to the theory outlined in Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig's seminal book Remix. It seems somehow fitting, or terribly ironic, that a perfectionist director, whose first student movie was a 1-minute collage ripped from magazines, should have his most famous work subjected to this 21st century form of collage. There's one more denial response worth mentioning. Denial of the dialogue, or at least denial of its delivery. Emily Asher Perrin, at the science fiction blog Tor.com, decided to take Lucas at his word when he called the prequels silent films, and watched the entire prequel trilogy with the sound turned down and John Williams' soundtrack CD in the background. It plays on a distinctly different emotional level, she concluded. It made me feel I understood what Lucas was going for. If you're baffled and upset at the idea that you might need to watch the prequels on mute in order to truly understand them, you're probably ready for the next stage of prequel grief. It's the one that leads to suffering and the dark side, if Yoda is to be believed. Anger. And there is perhaps no better example of sustained, simmering anger at the prequels than that which can be found in the Mr. Plinkett reviews. In 2009, a Milwaukee-based filmmaker called Mike Stolclasa produced a comprehensive